Hello, listeners. Today we're with Pastor John Hanna, who will talk with us about Arthur Carl Peepcorn, chaplain to the greatest generation. Pastor Hanna has recently presented on Peepcorn at the Lutheran Historical Conference and has graciously agreed to share his research with us here at TLHP. Our guest today, John Hanna, has served as a pastor in Royalton, Minnesota, the Bronx, New York, and he was a chaplain in the U.S. Army for 30 years. He earned degrees from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Princeton Theological Seminary, and Vanderbilt University Divinity School, and graduated from the U.S. Army War College. Pastor Hanna, thank you for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for asking.
Absolutely. So, first question, what made you decide to research and to present on Peepcorn?
Well, I've been a member of the Historical Conference for many years until I retired, and until my wife died, I never attended. I always read the journal. That's ingredient one. Ingredient two was I was a student of Peepcorn. He was my faculty advisor. He's the one who kind of nudged me into the Army chaplaincy. And I served a full career there, got out, and currently am in semi-retirement associate pastor at Our Savior in the Bronx. Pastor Sauer, who just left as pastor, joined the Army Reserve. It was, apart from my influence, he became an Army chaplain in the Army Reserve, and he was a fan of Arthur Carl Peepcorn, just as I am, even though he never met him. He did his master's research on Arthur Carl Peepcorn. So that prompted me to say to myself, I really would like to know more about what he did when he was an Army chaplain. We don't know a whole lot about that. So I decided to try and find out.
Yeah, he's a notable figure, especially in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and he spent a big time in the Army. So that would make sense, especially with your personal connection, to dig into that a bit more. So for listeners who maybe don't know much about him at all, could you give us a brief outline of his life before we discuss the details of your research?
Well, he was born in 1907 in Milwaukee. He was graduated from the seminary in 1928, so he was only 21. He skipped a few grades along, a couple of grades along the way. He was a veritable genius. Got a PhD from University of Chicago in Middle Eastern languages, Syrian languages. He did archaeological research there. And in 1933, he became pastor in Grace Church in Chisholm, Minnesota. He joined the Army Reserve in 1936 and stayed as a reservist or a guardsman, even after he moved to Ohio, Cleveland. In 1940, he was called to, or voluntarily, called to active duty for a year. This was under Roosevelt's mobilization program. During that time, during that year, he served soldiers who were on the Louisiana maneuvers in the 1st Infantry Regiment. The Army asked him to extend another year, which he did. During that extension year, came December 7th, 41, Pearl Harbor, which pretty much locked him in through the duration of the conflict. He went, after his service at Fort Snelling, he took the chaplain basic course He was the top of his class and far excelled everyone. They sent him to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, but that only lasted a couple of months. They brought him back to the chaplain school, realizing that he could really contribute to the training of the chaplaincy. While he was there, he was sent to the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. This is a prestigious military school for military career military officers. It's all about planning for war and conducting a war and so on and so forth, tactics and strategy. He was the first chaplain ever to attend that school. Then he went back to teaching at the school. He wasn't totally happy. He wanted to be with soldiers again. And he was. 1944, he joined the 23rd Corps. Corps is commanded by a two-star general. That time today, it's a three-star. So he served in that corps. And they were in Texas and surrounding states. The corps is a large unit with lots of subordinate units. until December, when he went to England with the corps. He went to Germany in April. April 2nd. Immediately after the German surrender, he was asked by his commanding general to open up elementary schools in the five states that was comprised the core area. He was asked, he was told that he was going to be the senior chaplain of the occupational forces in Germany, which would have meant he'd supervise 400, 500 chaplains. And as he told his wife, it would be the fourth or fifth most important position in the Army chaplaincy. Bear in mind, he'd only been on active duty for 5 years. That would have normally gone to someone who was approaching 60 years of age. Turned out that although he served that in that position temporarily, as it was establishing itself for 3 months, he was diverted to another assignment, namely to conduct the after-action report for all the chaplains in the European theater. That was a report that comprised almost 240 pages, legal-sized paper, single space. They conducted, he and three other chaplains and a whole bunch of enlisted folks interviewed 1,750 people who had been in the European theater, chaplains and others. That army was commanded by General George Patton. So he no doubt had some association with General Patton. After the war, he came back and went to the chaplain school, taught, and then he commanded for 2.5 years and left to be the president of the chaplain board for a year. And then he resigned from active duty, but remained in the reserve. And then he taught at Concordia Seminary. That from 1951 on.
And he died in 1973 then, correct? He
died in 1973.
All right.
Buried in church vestments, not in a uniform, not in academic garb, but a red chasuble.
I think in your presentation you mentioned he was a pastor first and foremost, no matter what he was doing in life.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That's how he presented himself to students.
So,
and a real gentleman. He did not hold his genius over anybody who was ignorant.
Yeah, in your presentation, you really reflected on his high character. And part of that character was, you mentioned that he had a Lutheran sense of Christian vocation that compelled him in the first place to become a chaplain in World War II. Could you explain to our audience your definition of Christian vocation?
Yeah, we get that mostly from Luther, who confronted the church at his of his time, where it was thought that a priest, and especially a bishop, was on a higher plane, had a higher vocation than anyone else. Of course, other high-ups would be kings and monarchs and princes and so on and so forth. But a lowly peasant was not worth as much. Luther took the doctrine of baptism and said, everyone who is baptized, who serves as a Christian, is equally worth in God's sight. So, for example, a garbage collector, sanitation worker, is just as important as a university professor, or even a bishop, or the president of the United States. It is important to serve your call where God placed you and do it to the best of your ability. Now, American Lutherans have distinguished themselves by establishing countless hospitals in the 19th century. My mother worked in one most of her career as a nurse, in social service agencies and schools, all the way from elementary to higher education, on the world, international level. We have American Lutherans established Lutheran World Federation and Immigration Refugee Service. So in World War II, many chaplains, many pastors left their chancels and pulpits to join their fellow Lutherans marching in the army or the other and the other services.
So you also stated that Piepcorn was the foremost of men who became Lutheran chaplains in World War II. I think that's a rather interesting statement. Well, what makes Piepcorn stand out to you in that sense?
Well, the positions he held in his rapid, much more rapid than usual advance. I think that most chaplains of that generation, and I've known a couple of them, a handful, maybe five or six, probably run across a dozen of them, and from several denominations, would agree that he was just recognized as an outstanding leader.
Okay, so you're saying that even other chaplains of his generation knew of him and respected him?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And as you mentioned earlier, he seemed to rather rapidly rise through the ranks and being given a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. In 1940, he was a lieutenant. 5 years later, 4.5 years later, he was a lieutenant colonel and a corps chaplain. He took the chaplain basic course in 42. And in 48, he commanded the chaplain school. Nobody's ever done that.
Yeah, that is quite amazing. And you said he is rather intelligent, and I think that it was demonstrated through that. So,
but he wasn't a geek, you know.
Yeah, if you look at pictures of him, he certainly doesn't look like that at all. He looks very, very serious, and yet very approachable at the same time. So how did Piepcorn describe the chaplain's character? What did that look like in practice?
he liked to use the word diakonia, which is a New Testament word for servant or service. Diakonos is the word for servant. So, again, it's Christian vocation. You are not above the people to whom you preach, for whom you preach, for whom you celebrate the Eucharist. You are a sinner like they are. And your job is to demonstrate with your person, the person of Christ, who gave everything for all of us.
Yeah. Do you have any examples of Peepcorn putting that into action, into practice as a chaplain?
Well, the primary example that I discovered, not really expecting it at all. I didn't even know he'd been on the Louisiana, famous Louisiana maneuvers. But he wrote when he was on the maneuvers for nearly 8 months, he wrote letters to his wife, Miriam, as often as possible, every day when possible. And in these letters, he describes numerous hardships, sleeping in the mud, in the cold, just at one point, sheer exhaustion. He talks about one day toward the end of the maneuvers when I believe 60 men fell out, just fell down exhausted. He came back to the camp carrying a soldier's weapon on one hand and helping the soldier on the other hand, because the soldier was exhausted, but he was exhausted. And at one point, he even said, I'm going to get out of this outfit.
Yeah. Why did he end up staying, even though he thought about leaving?
His sense of diakonia. And he said, after all, I'm no worse off than anybody else around me. This is where God has placed me. At the end of the letter, where he tells Miriam, I'm going to get out, and I'm thinking very seriously of getting out when my term is up in just a couple months. He said, by the way, I took time out to read the epistle of 1 John. It's a wonderful book about ministry and the chaplaincy. He probably read it in Greek, by the way.
That was his style, huh?
It was, at least later, but I'm sure then, too.
Yeah.
He didn't say that, but that would be my guess.
Yeah. And that's...
We were waiting in an airport for his plane once when he had visited me. And he had his Greek New Testament ready to read as during the flight. And he said at one time, and he had been stopped by security because of this foreign literature he was carrying.
Yes, I'm sure that was highly suspicious. Yeah, well, and that's, you know, not all Lutherans are like that, but I think that there's another Lutheran trait, right, to evaluate those original languages to get closer to what God's word was saying, but that is something special that he was doing that. Well, back into his time as a chaplain, you said at one point he was promoted to supervise 125 chaplains, and he already mentioned earlier he could have been supervising hundreds more. For a civilian and for audience members like me who don't really know what that all entails, what kind of duties would that include, supervising other chaplains?
In part, only in part, it would be like a bishop or a president, district president, or a synodical president, to do two things: coordinate the work of the ministry at a higher level. It means defending it before the commanding general. But more importantly, as far as he was concerned, it means supporting those in the lower units. There's a letter he got from a Methodist chaplain who thanked him profusely for his visit. This was a visit he made while they were in England and getting ready to go to Germany and into the midst of the war. And apparently this chaplain was quite fearful, understandably, and Peepcorn consoled him using scripture and prayer, for which he was most grateful.
Yeah. So the chaplain's chaplain would be an easy way to say it.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
Like a bishop is the pastor's pastor.
Yeah.
No, not all chaplains act that way, but that's the way he did.
Yeah. So, and he mentioned maybe having the possibility of maybe going before an army commander. Was there a lot of tension, do you know, between chaplains and the other officers at times?
Well, there certainly wasn't in his case. My experience is that there need not be. A chaplain who is lazy and doesn't engage with his soldiers, or a chaplain who deliberately makes trouble, would be on the outs with his commander. But I've always gotten along very well with commanders. And most chaplains do. We are actually welcomed, unless we misstep.
Mm-hmm. So some of his duties, you mentioned he was supervising other chaplains. At the end of World War II, you also mentioned already that he was assigned to supervise the reopening of many German schools. Why do you think he was picked for that? And again, what kind of duties would that include?
Well, he knew German. That would be first and foremost, I think. So he could speak to the local authorities about the schools. I didn't find much actual information about how he did it. I would assume it meant going to the local governor and talking to whatever minister of education for that district or state, and asking them if the army can help in any way, what they may need. And I'm just guessing here.
Yeah.
They might need some engineering work. The army has lots of engineers. With the war being done, they could be employed to do some rebuilding as necessary.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that the German language being key, probably, to that, one of the reasons. Was he a native German speaker? Did he grow up speaking German at home, or was that something he learned later on?
He learned it in prep school.
Okay.
At Concordia, Milwaukee, where he told me an interesting, curious story. He said sometime in high school, he had gotten an F in German class. And when he went back years later as an adult with a PhD teaching at the seminary, world-renowned theologian, and he checked his record, that someone had altered that F and changed it to a passing grade, at least. Didn't say which, but which grade. But he insisted that it remain an F. He said, I deserved that. I didn't do my work. So, yeah, he learned it. And, his ethnic background, of course, is German, like many of us. But he's German-American. It was prep school.
And that was part of his connection to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, wasn't it? He was a translator for him?
I suspect that. He also knew French, probably because of getting a PhD. But he was, we don't know this, there's no record of this. Because if it took place, it was classified, as General Eisenhower's travels would be. But we think he was with General Eisenhower on a trip to Switzerland, where Peepcorn served as his translator. There's good evidence that that's the case. There's orders giving Peepcorn permission to for temporary duty in Switzerland, and this was when the second senior commander in Europe was in command of the headquarters, not Eisenhower. The orders in those days always said by order of General whatever, and that those TDY orders said by order of General Patton, which means Eisenhower was gone, as was Peepcorn. He also wrote late to Miriam later that only 3 weeks later he said, so-and-so in Switzerland, forget the name, asked me to check on a theologian or pastor who might have been a prisoner of a war in America by the Americans. And he says, I checked and couldn't find anything. So, yeah, that's the only evidence we had. His sister told Dr. Philip Secker, who's got a website on Peepcorn. His sister told Secker that Peepcorn had gone with Ike. And there's good evidence that that was the case. Not conclusive, though.
So, yeah, a lot of circumstantial stuff. But, yeah, if someone finds the right secret file someday, it might be confirmed, huh? So I think you explained his career after the war already. So let's ask now, can you explain some of the different views Lutherans had or have had of military chaplains?
Well, the mainstream is also the mainstream of Christendom. There have been chaplains for 1,500 years in Christendom, and that was brought to America, and Lutherans participated beginning at least in the Civil War, probably in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah,
the mainstream of Lutherans applaud chaplains and believe it's an authentic and important ministry. There are two other views. A couple members of the old Synodical Conference, such as Wisconsin Synod, the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, object to pastors serving as chaplains. I haven't done much reading on that, but I suspect it's for two reasons. One, for fear of unionism, for being involved with clergy of other denominations with which we don't agree. And secondly, it's very different than being a parish pastor. I, even though I served an entire career as an army chaplain, I think parish pastor is more important and more fulfilling. But being a chaplain is different. So it requires adjustment. That's the second view. A third view is the pacifist argument. This became prominent in after Vietnam or during Vietnam, namely that Christian clergymen should not be associated with the corruption of military forces who are killing, and causing violence and so forth. So just by being there gives permission for them to do that. And they actually believe we shouldn't have any military.
Interesting. So, yeah.
Three views. Yes, no, and no. No for two different reasons.
Yeah, it's kind of opposite ends for no. Yeah. Well, as a Wisconsin Synod guy, of course, I knew the Wisconsin perspective, but I never heard of that pacifist no answer. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. I was going to interrupt you earlier. I had just found there's a translated diary of a German Lutheran chaplain who came with the Hessian troops in the American Revolutionary War. So those were probably there were more Lutherans possibly on the opposing side of the revolution, and they had chaplains for sure as part of their military structure. I don't know about the Americans, but yeah, you mentioned there was a long history of Lutheran chaplaincy, especially starting in the Civil War and after that. I know the Wisconsin Synod does have chaplains. They're not in the military at all, but they do have a call to be located near major army bases, and they will serve, but totally different.
That is correct, and I've met them.
Yeah, but them. Yes. Very different though from what your experience was and the other chaplains. All right. Do you think Peepcorn influenced the Lutheran view of chaplaincy at all by his service and his example and the way he presented it as a professor?
Yes, I think so. Although, again, he's not the only one. There were a whole host of Lutherans who served beginning in World War II and after, and to this day. And a disproportionate number of them rise to leadership positions. He was probably the earliest and the fastest. He, as seminary professor, kind of on the side, it wasn't a big deal, but once a year he conducted an assembly, which was optional, wasn't one a required assembly, explaining the chaplaincy. He and others who had served in World War II talked to whoever came. That's how I got in.
Yeah, I guess in one way you are living evidence of how he influenced the chaplaincy. He influenced you to be part of it, right? And yeah, others.
My daughter listened to the presentation I gave to the historical conference and said, "Dad, that's you." She's very much aware of my career.
Yeah. Well, final content question before we move on to our next section. We're right on schedule for time. But to wrap it up, in your view, why does Peepcorn deserve to be remembered?
I'll just say one thing. In this era of American Lutheranism, where we are seemingly hopelessly divided, if there is any possibility for finding a center, Peepcorn would be kind of at the center of that, or would be a good beginning to find the center of Lutheranism in the framework of American politics. I'm not sure this completely is analogous, but he was an originalist toward our Constitution. He was clear what our Constitution is. It wasn't simply Luther, or the name Lutheran, or our immediate history. Our Constitution is the Book of Concord, the entire book of Lutheran confessions. He preferred not to be called a Lutheran, but to be called part of the Church of the Augsburg Confession. So if we are to find a center, he would be a good beginning.
Yeah, well, he would join Luther in not wanting to be called Lutheran, right? Luther, yes, himself said, indeed, call yourself a Christian after Christ. But the name stuck, and I guess I'm okay with using the word Lutheran. But
I don't think we're going to change it.
I don't think we are either. But no, I think that's a valuable contribution there to point. What are we founded on? What's our focus going to be? All right. Well, now we'll move into section two, quite a bit shorter, but this is also not just a Lutheran podcast, but a Lutheran history podcast. So we like talking about the historical process. What was your research method like?
Well, it begins with my own memory and of my association with Peepcorn. Then we moved to, I've already mentioned, Dr. Philip Secker and his website called the Center of Arthur Carl Peepcorn Studies, some such name. He gave a biography, including a military chronology, which I could see was not complete, and it was certainly the best that he could produce. And that, you know, that I've had for years, my memory of him and Secker's work. So I decided if I'm going to study this, I need to go to the archives in Elk Grove Village, the archives of the ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, has 148 boxes of peepcorn stuff.
Oh, my goodness. That's a lot.
They're well cataloged. So some of them have military, some of them are named military orders. There's lots of correspondence. So I began there looking at military orders, which I could decipher based on my own experience. You almost have to know what you're looking at. And I did. So I was able to establish a good chronology, where he was when. And then correspondence during those years, beginning when he was a reserve chaplain. And all those letters to his wife, as well as letters to the church commission, which endorsed chaplains. That gave me most of the material that I have. He was incredibly affectionate toward Marian. For example, he had a new salutation every day, an affectionate salutation. And I don't remember any of them, but they were incredibly insightful and delicious and really interesting.
I hope my wife doesn't listen to this one. He's going to make me look bad.
Yeah, mine too. I was rather straightforward, you know, all down to business.
Yeah.
And then I went to, there are a few things of military value at Concordia Historical Institute in St. Louis. For example, that report, 238-page report is there. His handbook on denominations that chaplains must support is there. I'd never seen that. So that was interesting.
Well, you're fortunate to have, you know, one major center with so much material all in one spot. And then, of course, Concordia as well. I know for a lot of people doing research, especially on kind of biographical on individuals within the Lutheran Church, they have to go all across the country or maybe across the world because they serve in so many different places and they leave a little paper trail here and there, but you had a lot of material, but centrally located. Now, that being said, were there some challenges in conducting your research?
Well, you know, I don't have any information or much information on command of the chaplain school, which would be an important era. And I don't know where I would get that. Miriam was with him then, so he wasn't writing her.
So you got a lot of your insights from those letters, and of course, if they're living at the same location, it's all verbal, right? it's right, lost. Right. Yeah, lost information.
I'm sure somewhere in the Army archives there would be something.
Yeah.
Which would be another thing I'd like to look at. That would be his personnel records. I don't even know if they're open to anybody. Not even sure where they are, but I think they're in St. Louis.
What are those for people who don't know the lingo? What's a personnel record?
I assume it was much the same as today. It would include all orders, where you are. It would include all your awards. any disciplinary action if there were, if there had been some. But more importantly, what we call today, we call effectiveness report, officer effectiveness report. That would be the commander's assessment, and that comes annually, whether you want it or not, the commander's assessment of your work. That's what promotion boards look at. Now, it would be really interesting to read all those.
Yeah, especially since he was promoted so often, so quickly. What were in those reports that made people think he's worthy of promotion? Yeah.
And now, you going back to another question, how to get along with commanders. Back in the Louisiana maneuvers, when the Army asked him to stay another year, he had to put in paperwork to apply for that, which they would have approved, or they did approve, actually. But he needed to go to his congregation because he was on a one-year leave of absence, needed to go to his congregation in Cleveland to ask them again for one more year. And to do that, he had to get his commander to approve leave. So I went to his commander, regimental commander, colonel, and said, I need to do this. The commander said, well, I don't want to interfere with your relationship with your church. That's important to you. But you ought to stay in the Army and get, you know, because you're doing a great job. He explained this to Miriam and said, Colonel Sanchez is not the kind of person to waste time with praise.
Yeah.
And when it came time for him to endorse the application for the year extension, the commander wrote, not only approved, but he's, you know, he's a great asset to the Army and should stay, blah, blah, blah. The personnel officer said, he never does that. He just says approved.
So, yeah, that was probably a big part in keeping him in the Army after that one-year turning point.
Yeah, and his rise.
Yeah. So, final question for this section. Do you have any future plans for your project, for your research on Peepcorn?
I don't. I would, if I ever found out I could look at the personnel records, I would certainly jump at that opportunity, or the work at the chaplain school.
Now, if people wanted to access their research, your research on this, will there be any opportunity to see that in the future?
Well, actually, I'm glad you asked. I have a book coming out. My presentation was just simply a digest of my book, which is in process right now. Should be on the street in a month or so.
Congratulations on that. Who's publishing it?
By American AOPB Books, AOPB.org.
Very good. Well, we look forward to seeing that available in the near future. So, final question. If you have advice for other Lutheran historians, what would you like to see more research being done on within Lutheran history?
We're getting close to the time when there should be work done on the last quarter century of the 20th century, where the Lutherans got very, very active, very divided, and animated, which determined in a couple of years, let's say from 1969 until 1985 or 88, the course of American Lutheranism was set. That period needs to be examined more thoroughly.
All right. Well, hopefully in the future we'll have a podcast or two on that era, and you'll be able to hear more about that. Okay. Well, today we heard about Arthur Carl Peepcorn. I always want to say Carl Arthur. I don't know why, but it's Arthur Carl Peepcorn, especially focusing on his time in the military, which has not received as much focus as maybe the later part of his life. So thank you, Pastor Hannah, for your time and your research.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So in 2 weeks, plus a day, we do every 15 days, look for another episode on Lutheran history. So if you like this episode or think of someone you know who may find it interesting, please share it. The best way to keep up with Lutheran History Podcast is to follow the podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, or whatever platform you are using.